Okay, good morning, everybody. We're on Daf Chaf Zayin, sorry to interrupt. I've been wrong before, a couple of times. And specifically, a few weeks ago, I said this is going to be the quickest Daf we've ever had, and then it was like the longest Daf we ever had. But I am like pretty confident, like 90% confident, that this is going to be the quickest Daf we've had. There's no agadat on this stuff. There are essentially five sections, and we'll move at due speed, so we'll see what happens. This is also code for me saying I didn't have a huge amount of time to do a lot of reflecting or cogitating on the material, so we'll basically translate, go through, and make observations along the way, but also we have some time constraints on the other end. So to get a sense of where we are, context, we're on the second daf of the last perek. The previous daf was essentially a Mishnah, where we went through what are the topics of the final chapter, and largely we said it's to do with relationships. We finished the final observation of the final Mishnah of the Masechet, celebrates Tu B'Av, which was the day on which young couples would go matchmaking, by which I mean young men would go and pick or choose a match, and that was used as a metaphor to speak about our relationship with God as a people, that God, we should celebrate the relationship we forged with God at Har Sinai, the relationship we forged in building the Bet Mikdash. And then we have going through last daf and today is going to be about the relationship between the priests and the people, the temple and the citizenry, between text and revelation. We're going to talk about some ritual things that come up today. When we lane, there has to be minimum number of psukim each aliyah is. What do we do? What's the minimum number of psukim for each aliyah?
Three.
What happens if the section you're laning only has five psukim? Right. Do you repeat the middle verse so the first person does 1 to 3 and the second person does 3 to 5? Or do you split the middle verse in half and you do 1 to 2.5 and then 2.5 to 5? That's going to be a debate. What are the values at play in that distinction? But we're also going to have some historical questions. How many Mishmarot were there? Anyone remember? 24. When did that start? In the Beit HaMikdash? Who started the whole idea of Mishmarot, that there should be somebody standing there? Moshe. We'll find out, is that the case? Is that a debate? How many were there? We'll go through. So, top of page, Chav Zayin Amud Aleph. If it's helpful, the Mishnah was in three parts. Firstly was three occasions when you would duchen every available opportunity. Yom Kippur, you duchen at every opportunity. Ta'anit, you duchen at every opportunity, which is why it's coming up here. And then Ma'amadot, you duchen at every opportunity, which is why we're now on a lengthy discussion about what is the Ma'amad? What is this concept that seems not to be in play today? The Mishnah then said, what are the five events that took place on Shiva Sabatama's five events took place on Tisha B'Av, and then the two greatest occasions on the Jewish calendar, Yom Kippur and Tu B'Av, and then the Gemara begins. Let's go back to the start with Ma'amadot, and we'll find our way through the Mishnah as we go through. We're in the middle of a question at the top of the page, which said, hold on a minute, you seem to be under the impression, the Gemara says, that the Kohanim cannot drink when they're duchening, which is why, I mean, this comes up once in the Jewish calendar today, really. Simchas Torah, when we duchen at Shacharis as opposed to Musaf, which is incredibly unusual. And the reason we duchen at Shacharis is because we know all the Kohanim are drunk by the time we get to Musaf. Also that we're going to make Kiddush so that we don't want that people be drinking and then duchen, so we duchen early. So the one said, hold on a minute, how do you know that Kohanim can't drink when they're duchening? It was debating, do you do it at Mincha, do you do it at Ne'ilah? Maybe you don't because they would drink and people might get confused. So who says they can't drink? We say, well, it's compared to a Nazir. The passage that talks about Kohanim doing brachot is right next to the passage about Nazirut. And then the Gemara said, hold on a minute, you're comparing a Kohen Mevarech to a Nazir. What else can a Nazir do? So, exactly. There are a few things, go near the dead, cut their hair, but primarily, it's not just wine that Nazirim can't drink. They can't eat any grape-related products. They can't have grape skins. Are you telling me a Kohen Mevarech can't have grapes during his Mishmar or during his Mevarech? So the Gemara says, no, because he's also compared to a Masharet. And a Masharet is a Kohen doing the Avodah. And a Kohen doing an Avodah is allowed to eat grapes. So he's now compared both to a Masharet, meaning a regular Kohen doing the service, and a Nazir. And the Gemara says, hold on a minute. You're comparing him to a Kohen who does the service. What other rule pertains to a kohen doing the service. What is that kohen not allowed to have? The Gemara says right at the top, Ima Mesharis Balmum Lo, Avkon Mevaros Balmum Lo. If you're telling me that they're compared to a kohen doing the avoda, then a Balmum should be disqualifying. And so now you're telling me, in theory, that kohen shouldn't be able to eat any grapes, and in theory, the kohen shouldn't have any Balmum before they duchen. Now, do we say that a kohen duchen and can't have a Balmum? Say again? You don't say that. Right, so it turns out it's a little complicated. There are views that today, when Kohanim go up to Duchen, they shouldn't have an overt Balmum, but it's, bless you, but it's not because of the association with the Kohanim and the Bet Midrash doing the Avodah. It's essentially so that people don't get distracted. So if somebody's got what would be qualified as an internal Balmum, that for a Kohen in the Bet Midrash would be disqualifying. For example, there's a large debate whether wearing glasses is considered a balmum for a kohen, meaning because without any assistance, you're walking into walls, you can't see anything. So, well, not everyone, but I would. So is that considered a balmum? So if you're duchening, that is not considered a balmum, because it's not distracting, it's regular, people do that. But if somebody is missing a limb, that is often material for poskim to say maybe they shouldn't duchen, maybe they should, maybe people should just not look, and shouldn't be distracted, there's a back and forth. If it comes up practically, we'll deal with it. Yes.
Well, you're not supposed to be looking anyway.
Yeah. Well, on the way up, you're going to get distracted. Yeah. Yes, but everyone does, exactly. So, it is not the case that a kohen with a balmum is inherently disqualified from doing duchening. So you can't compare and say, basically what the Gemara is now doing is saying, you're comparing the duchening kohen to two different sources, to the nazir, to say that he can't drink wine, and to the kohen, to say, to the serving kohen, to say that he doesn't have to worry about a balmum. But in theory, you could compare them in the strict way in both directions. You can say the kohen duchening can't eat grapes, and can't have a balmum. You've got a very limited group through the comparison. And basically, we're doing something very unrabbinic, which is comparing to make leniencies. To say, well, there's a kula here, they can eat grapes even though Nazirim can't, and they don't have to balmum even though a Kohen Masharik can't have a balmum. So why are we taking the leniencies? The Gemara says, why are you making these lenient comparisons? You should compare to both. They have a very strict rule for who is doing the blessing. So to some degree, there is a theology beneath the surface here, that who is it who gets to engage with the people? Is it a very narrow group of Kohanim who get to come face to face and bless the people? People who have had no contact with grapes, meaning they are an incarnate Nazir and an incarnate Masharet. They have no Balmum. They have no contact with the outside world. They are hermetic in the sense of being hermits, in a strict sense. Or are we saying, actually, the comparison we're making is, you shouldn't be drunk. You should have clarity of mind, and you take that from the Nazir, but you're not hermetic like the Nazir who doesn't come in contact with anything, and you're like the Kohen who's serving, which excludes you from that, but you can have a Balmum. You don't have to be a perfect human physiological specimen. We could talk at length about why Balmum should be disqualifying anyway in a world in which disabilities are seen not as disqualifying. We don't, that's not our central topic, but I'll just flag that as something for discussion at a later date. So why are we comparing to this middle ground? Asmachta ninhu midrabanan olukula. The Gemara concludes, well, this whole comparison business is rabbinic. Whether the Kohen Mevarech is like a Nazir or whether he's like a Masharet, it's all a rabbinic asmachta just to make the case homiletically, essentially, so we can go lukula. Full stop. Elohen Ma'amado, this in gray is quoting from the Mishnah. Every time I have a quote from the Mishnah, I do in gray. Elohen Ma'amado, Lefi Shneir Matzav Bnei Yisrael. The Mishnah said, these are the Ma'amadot, and the Pasuk says, command the Jewish people. So the Gemara is about to make an observation that we make sometimes when we read the Chumash, specifically in Parshat Toldot, Ve'ela Toldot, no, not in Parshat Toldot, Parshat Vayeshev, when we're told, Vayeshev Yaakov Esperes Megurei Aviv, Ve'ela Toldot Yaakov, and these are the generations of Yaakov, and then what does the Pasuk say? Yosef, and then it goes on to the story of Yosef. And one says, what happened? You said, these are the generations of Yaakov, and then you start talking the Yosef story, and all the exegetes say, oh, this is to suggest that the episode of Yosef interrupted something in history, was something unnatural, it was a response to Yaakov's behavior, whatever the case may be. So the Mishnah says, Elohen Ma'amado, these are the Ma'amado. And then out of nowhere says, oh, the Pasuk says, and the Gemara is eventually saying, my karma, what's going on here? Hachi karma. The Gemara says, this is how it should be read. Elu hena ma'amadot. These are the following ma'amadot. But before we detail them, ma tam tikna ma'amadot. What are ma'amadot doing? Why do we have a group of common Jews, Yisraelim, standing in the Bet Mikdash in rotation, watching what's going on? Seems voyeuristic, speculative. What are they doing standing there? Lefish and Emma, it says in the verse that we read in Korbanot each morning, or is written in the Siddur each morning, and we count to 35, and then we say Kaddish. I'm kidding, nobody does that. And we'll see in a minute that Korbanot are actually central in the rabbinic liturgical imagination. Hashem says to the Jewish people, or to Moshe, command the Jewish people and say to them, these are my Korbanot, these are my sustenance, this is my fires. And the Gemara says, how could it possibly be associated? How can you say to the Jewish people, you're in partnership with me, these are our korbanot, this is the korban tamid, the communal sacrifice, and the Jewish people are just going around their business and someone brings it for them? How can they possibly think that they have no connection with this korban that's being brought on their behalf? You should have some sort of relationship. Hitkinu Nevi'im HaRishonim, the early prophets determined. Who are the early prophets? Good question. We're going to have to figure that out in the yellow beneath. Esrim v'arba mishmarot, I'll call mishmar, mishmar haya ma'amad v'yushalayim shal kohanim shal levim shal yisraelim. There are 24 groups of kohanim split up so that they have rotation. They're not just the standard kohanim in the Bet Mikdash all the time. Why might that be? Why would Nevi'im say, we don't want the same kohanim all the time in the Bet Mikdash, we want to have a rotation? Why would you say you want to have a rotation?
You don't want to change.
Okay, so one option is, or one component, let's say, is you want everyone to have a chance. Not that you shouldn't be standard people who get it all the time and everyone's walking around thinking, I'm a Cohen, what am I? Drop liver Cohen, I don't get to go. That's one. Avoiding corruption. One of the critiques of hierarchical religions is that you go in well-intentioned, and then you spend a lot of time in isolation, in your ivory tower, a lot of donations come in, there's no real oversight, and it basically becomes a corrupt cabal of priests. And we need things to be on rotation, so people get it to go out into the people, see the people who they're serving. They don't have access to power all the time. There's a sense of oversight. Is that what you were saying? Excellent. So those are two possibilities. And they said, we need to have 24 mishmar of Kohanim. There was an equivalent grouping of the Jewish people, 24 sections that were split up, and they would go and be in the Bet Mikdash to watch what was going on. So to some degree, you've got supervision of the Kohanim, but that wasn't the primary reason they're there. Why are they there? So that they can be involved on behalf of the rest of the nation. They are representing them in these korbanot. The priests don't just do this behind, you know, Wizard of Oz style, behind the curtain. This is something which every person in the nation is connected to through representation. Higiyazman mishmar lalakon mevim alim Yerushalayim. And when the time came for the mishmar to go up, the kohanim mevim in Israel would also go up to Yerushalayim. First one in the line is la'alot, end of the line, Tana Rabbanan, Tafresh. Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, Esrim v'arba, and this is going to seem like a question, 24 mishmarot be'eretz Yisrael, l'shtayim esrei be'yericho. There were 24 mishmarot in Israel and 12 in Yericho. How many is that altogether? 36. Shtayim esrei be'yericho? Oh, you're saying there are 12 in Yericho and Nefishin Lantuva. That's too many. You said there's 24. Now you're saying there's 36. The one says, no. It doesn't mean there were 24 in Israel and 12 in Yericho. 12 of the 24 were in Yericho. So there were 24 units of Kohanim split up. 12 of them would spend time in Yerushalayim, and 12 of them would spend time in Yericho, meaning it would get divided in half. Each group would get, half of them would be in Yerushalayim, and half would be in Yericho. He gives man a mishmar la'alot, when it's time for the mishmar to take their turn in the on rotation. Chatzi a mishmar haya olam eretz Yisrael Yerushalayim. Half of them would go to Yerushalayim. Chatzi a mishmar haya olam Yericho, and half of them would go to Yericho. Kadesh yisbeku mayim mazin lachem shem Yerushalayim, so that they could provide food for their brethren in Yerushalayim. I'm not sure why they had to go to Yericho to get food, but that seems to be the place food would get provided for the Kohanim. Full stop. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, we're about to have a debate. Who here, if you had a choice between listening to a classical musical concert or going to an opera, putting aside questions of your rabbinic permissibility of these things, what would you enjoy listening to on recording, let's say, more? Classical instrumental or an opera? And I know...
Instrumental? Can't understand an opera.
An English opera.
Okay.
Can you understand the instrumental? Say again? Yeah, that's true. Okay, good. So we seem to have a universal agreement in here that we don't like people singing. That's good. Well, there's a debate here. What is the purpose of music in the Bet Mikdash? What would make it most elevated? Was it the singing of the Levites? And I'm sure we all know some Levium who we think maybe they shouldn't be in the choir. I think I told you when I was in elementary school in year six, fifth grade, they had a school play, and it was not in the PC era yet. And I had friends, we all had to audition for a part, and people auditioned to sing, people auditioned to play, and everybody got a role, apart from two kids who were not good at acting, and they were told, as they started singing in the choir, that maybe you should just mime. I thought, that's unbelievable. People's parents came to see them, and they knew they were just standing there. Everybody clapped. Anyway, so hopefully there weren't Levim, but Levim had a role to sing in the Bet Mikdash, and of course, if they couldn't sing well or didn't want to sing well, what was the other role Levim had? Opening and closing the doors. And in fact, Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik is often quoted as having said, I'm a Levi, I don't have a voice. If I was, you know, people would say, oh, Rabbi Soloveitchik, you're the giant leader of the generation. And say everything, I don't know the context, but he was told, you know, everything's timing. If I would have been born 2,000 years ago, I would have been a gatekeeper. I was a Levi, I don't sing, and the Kohanim were the teachers, I would have been opening and closing doors. I happened to be born in the...
The name Soloveitchik means Emmanuel, and it was meant as a...
Praise of the voice.
Not praise, but the family was known not to sing well, so it was like mocking them.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, they kept the name.
A satirical name.
Interesting. Well, I've heard Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik talk about the Soloveh, what will the Soloveh sing next? But he didn't admit that it was essentially a way of mocking the family. Interesting. So they didn't pick the name?
No.
Or they're self-mocking?
Well, this was very common. Government officials would give mocking names to people.
Wow, so even the government thought they couldn't sing.
Yeah.
Nice. Interesting. I won't mention that to him next time I see him. Yeah, I will. All right, great, thank you. So the Levim used to sing, and they were instrumental, so you had people playing music. What was the key in the Bet Mikdash? Was it the instrumental, which you all seem to identify with as preferring, or was it the singing? There's one Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel says, if you want the Korban to work, it is conditional for a Korban to have the Kohanim Levim and Yisrael standing there. But Matnita Tana was taught in a Brayta. It's not just the Kohanim Levim in brackets and the Yisraelim, but you need to have the instruments playing in order for the Korban to work. This astonishing view. If you don't have the instruments playing, Korban doesn't work. Well, you've got to wait at least to bring the Korban. And here the question, but my kamiflagi, what are they arguing about? Something, the central role of music in the Bet Mikdash was vocal, and something, the central role of music in the Bet Mikdash was instrumental. And if it was just vocal, you don't need this instrument, say, you can just say, oh, the instruments aren't working, they're not tuned, just sing and begin, or do we have to wait for the instrumentals? Again, if we had time to plumb this, more depth we could. We could speak about the role of music in Jewish life generally. We've got the Omer coming up, the 3 weeks, etc. Full stop. Amram ben Gurion, here we've got about 25 lines of history. Amram ben Gurion says, in the name of Rav, Amar Rav, Moshe tikilem nizol shmona mishmarot arba me'elezer dalem itamra. Moshe once who instituted the Kohanic role. How many Kohanim were there when first installed? Well, Aaron and... Arun Uvanav. So at some point there may have been five. Then Nadav and Avihu passed away, to put it lightly, and we're left with Elazar and Itamar and Aaron Akon. So 24 units, not going to work. Now it turns out Elazar and Itamar did have some children, so with some grandkids involved, but also 24 units, that's not a lot of, that's too much. So Moshe, when he inaugurated the system, Shmona Mishmaret, he had eight rotations. Arba Me'elazava, Arba Me'itamar. Four from each of Aaron's lines of descent. But Shmuel came. How long after Moshe was Shmuel? A fair amount of time. He was there to inaugurate the first king. Shaul HaMelech, David HaMelech. This is about 400 years later. Shmuel comes. He said there should be 16 units. It's enough population now. It's getting too many Kohanim here in each rotation. But David was the one who divided it into 24, which is not long after Shmuel, meaning that Shmuel was involved in him being inaugurated. So this was the next generation tells you something about how bureaucracy sometimes works, leadership sometimes works, sometimes reactive, sometimes proactive. David is seen here as a proactive figure. Presumably it wasn't in the space of one generation that it suddenly exploded, but he said we need to do more to make this workable. How do we know? Shneimar says in the Pasuk, Bishnat ha-arba'im l'malchut David, in the 40th year of David's kingship, Nidrushev yimatsevim g'brachal b'yazeh Gilead, they found these heroic figures, i.e. Kohanim, they divided them up from Yazeh Gilead, so he was the one who said it. So historically, it was Moshe, 8, Shmuel, 16, David, 24. Meitfei, we have a brighter that seems to disagree. Moshe tekan lem yitosh shmona mishmarot, arba melazar, arba mitamar. Moshe said there were 8 initially, 4 from Elazar and 4 from Itamar. Bar David and Shmuel, so who comes? David and Shmuel together, v'amidam alazar and v'arba. There was no intermediary stage, but there were 24 units set up together by David and Shmuel. Shnemar, as it says, and this is quoting from Divrei Yamim in all these cases, hemi yasa David and Shmuel, it was established. Through David and Samuel, Haroeb and Munatam, who saw in their loyalties or their commitment, it was set up. Hachi Kama, now this is what it means. Meyosto shall David Ishmol Aramati Imdomales and Barba, as a combination of their legislations that amounted to 24. So we have this debate. It was Moshe, then Shmuel, then David. One writer says, no, Shmuel and David did it together. And the Shmuel says, no, it just means that as a result of their legislation, it emerged over time. What's at core in that debate or that question? We'll leave for another time. Tani Idach, it was taught in another brighter. And this is going to make it sound like Moshe established even more Mishmarot over time. Moshe Tikalem Yisrael. How many did Moshe establish? Sheshe Esrei Mishmarot. Shmonim Elazar, Mishmonim Itamar. He established that there would be 8 from Elazar and 8 from Itamar. Ukusharabu b'nei Elazar al b'nei Itamar. And where Elazar's population exploded, we have the census controversies emerging now. I don't know why I saw this, but my phone last night told me that there was some Detroit has complained about the census, saying that they were 8% short on their count. They need to count again. Sometimes you have population changes and explosions in one place rather than others. I think New York shrunk. Am I right that in the census? People moved further out west last time they did the census in 2020. So B'nai Elazar, kind of mass population explosion. B'nai Nitamar stayed stable. So Moshe said, okay, this isn't stable. We need to address the population shift. Let's make 24 units. So he started with 16, and who made 24? Moshe, Shneimar, as it says. This is reported again in Divrei Yamim. It was discovered that Elazar had more people than Itamar. And it was divided with 16 to Elazar and 8 to Itamar. Omer, and it continues to say two psukim later, Beit Av Echad Echos Elazar. There was an extra one set aside for Elazar, meaning the ratio was 2-1. So you had 16 for Elazar and 8 for Itamar. Achos Echos Leitamar, and it was stable for Itamar. Maiva Omer, why does it have this extra pasuk? V'chitem, because you might say, Ki hechet nefishe ben Elazar hachinami nefishe ben Itamar. You might say, no, they both increased. Moshe only had 4 initially, and they both increased over time, but it says, Shemana me'ikara abba havu tashma, that's why it says, Beit av echad achos le'alazar v'achos echos le'itamar. Itamar stayed stable, meaning the historical development was not chronological over time, but it was instantaneous in Moshe's age. Full stop. Teyuvta to Rav Chama Bar Guria, this sounds like a disputation. Teyuvta means it has been rejected. It sounds like Rav Chama Bar Guria has been rejected. It was not a process with Moshe, Shmuel, and David. It was all Moshe. What is the difference? I mean, it's a historical question. Who was the one who set up 24? At some level, it's also about the power of later prophets to legislate and make regulation. Is it all Moshe who has to be responsible for everything? There was 8, and if there's a change, Moshe's got to do it to 16, and there's a change, got to be 24. Or can later leaders come along and regulate depending on the age? Rav Chama Bar Guria responds and says, Amlach Rav Chama Bar Guria, he would say Tanaihi. Anyone know what it means, Tanaihi? Right, this is an earlier debate. Rav Chama says, yeah, you can tell me that there's a brighter that disagreed with me, and I'll show you a brighter that disagrees with you. This is an earlier debate that has been around for a while. Va'ana da'amriki haitana da'amashmona. And I follow the view that Moshe set up 8. So what you have here is an instantiated, irresolvable dispute. It's a historical question, so you might think, you know, who cares? Was it Moshe? Was it David? Was it Shmuel? It's a historical dispute, so let's just skip it. But it seems to also have ramifications about who has the power to make communal decisions, and does that power continue after Moshe? And he says, I'm of the view that we do. Moshe only set up 8, and it was David and Shmuel who made the changes, but there are other brayot that disagree. Full stop. And talking on the subject of continuity between the people and the priests in the past and the present, we now turn to a time in history when there should have been 24 units of Kohanim, but not everybody came back. Tana Rabbanan and the rabbis taught, two lines up, Arba'a mishmarot alumina gola. During the second Aliyah, after the exile with Ezra, the Jews came back, and by the Jews came back, I mean a small number of Jews came back. If you look in the commentary of Rashi, right at the bottom, two lines up, alumina gola, b'bayit sheni, during the second temple era, v'hashar lo alu, nobody else came up, shaharba mi'Yisrael nishtaru, many of the Jews remained in Babylon, v'larazu la'alot, and they didn't want to come up. So the Gemara says, when they came up from Gola, only 4 of the 24 Mishmarot came up. Now, what are Mishmarot made up of? Kohanim. So we're not talking about the disenfranchised Yisrael who said, I've got nothing to do with the temple, I'm very happy in the diaspora. These are the Kohanim who would have been involved in the temple service, who seem to be saying, we're very comfortable, we're not interested. And we could talk about Zionism again another time. The suggestion here is, what is 20 of 24? 4/5? Thank you. 5/6? Yeah, 1/6 came back. 5/6 said, is that right? 5/6? It's not 6/6.
A large percentage.
6/6 is
24.
6/4
is 24.
6? 4 is 24. 6/4 is 6? Yes, 6. Yes, so it's not 5/6 came back.
No, 5/6 didn't come back.
Thank you. 5/6, it's very early in the morning. Very early in my career. So 4 of the Mishmarot, 1/6, thank you, came back. Ve'eluhen, and these are their names, Yediah, Charim, Pashchor, Ve'imar. Those are the 4 families that came back. And 5/6, I'm told, of the Kohanim said, we're not interested. So what happened? Nevi'im Shebeinehem, the prophets among them. Who are the prophets among them? Presumably. But what the Gemara seems to be insinuating here, building off the last discussion, is prophets in each age, whoever they may be, have the Mosaic capacity to make these regulatory decisions. So this is almost a endorsement of Rabbi Chaim ben Guri in the last section. Chilkum, so over the page, the prophets of that age divided up the Kohanim who came up. Ve'emidim al esrim va'arba, and said that I know only 4 groups came back, but we're going to divide your 4 groups into 24. Balalum v'natnum b'klapei, they would take the names of each of these families, fold them on paper and put them in a hat so you could draw out who would go first. How'd you establish order? There was order in the old system, in the first temple, but they got exiled, they came back, only 4 families came back. They were not in the same order, of course, as previously, because half the, 5/6 of the list was missing. How did you determine who came first? They put the names in a hat. By Yediah, Yediah would come to the hat. He would pick his name and the other 5 components of his division that had been set up and put them in the right order. And Charim would do the same. And they would do the same thing. And that's how they determine the order of the new 24 system. And the prophets among them then also decreed, even if the figure who was the chief god in the first temple. So now we're being told not only did 5/6 of the Kohanim not come back, but the leaders, how long was that exile while they were in Babel? 70 years. That's not a huge amount of time. I mean, it's not 2 weeks, but 70 years is not a huge amount of time. People knew people who were there in the first temple era. We have reports of the inauguration of the second temple where there were people there who had been at the first temple who were crying because it wasn't quite as dramatic as the first temple. And nonetheless, the chief priests of the first temple didn't bother coming back. And the Nevi'im of this age, the second age, said, even if those chief ones come back from Yoyadiv, they come back, lo yidche Yediah mimkamo. They don't supersede Yediah, who came back. And he's now head, and you don't get to come back and say, oh, well, you know, we're on the bandwagon now because everything seems to be going well and we were quite comfortable, but this looks quite inspiring. Said, no, you missed your chance, you're not going to come first. You do get inserted into the system because you're part of the Kohanim rotation. Yediah stays at the top. You could enter in and we'd have to replace one of the other Mishmarot with you, make the division again. Full stop. Those are some historical questions. Now we said during this ma'amad, half the ma'amad would be in Yerushalayim watching the proceedings of the sacrifices, half the ma'amad would be back in the local towns. So if the temple is rebuilt, half of us are going to be part of the ma'amad for this section, half of us would go to Yerushalayim to watch, and half of us would stay in the Angadol Jamaica States. And every day during our rotation, we'd be in the shul, and we would read Ma'aseh Bereishit. And the Gemara is about to say, what on earth is that the appropriate text for? If you're going to say, the sacrifice is happening in Yerushalayim, half you will be here and pray, half you will be there and watch, you'd think, well, what kind of tzukim would you think we should be reading in shul to connect to that experience? Yeah, think Korbanot. Why are you reading Ma'aseh Bereishit? I mean, just make people think of Simchas Torah. So the Gemara says, Menayin Mili, where do you get this from? Amar Biakob Achob Amar Rabasi. These sages suggested, Ilmale Ma'amadot lo nitkaimu shamayim va'aris. If it was not for the Ma'amad, the cosmos would disintegrate. So it seems to be suggesting, you say Ma'aseh Bereishit to suggest that the whole universe is underpinned by these practices, which is going to beg which question? Are they happening right now, those practices?
No.
Is the cosmos gone? Yes. Not as far as we know. So how do we account for that gap? So this is, again, going to be part of this theme. How do we establish a continuity with the past in the present? And we're going to have something from Avram here, which is going to make us feel guilty, and me guilty, for that joke about Korbanot before. Rabasi says, if it wasn't for the Korbanot and the Ma'amadot, the whole cosmos would disintegrate, Shneimar, as it says. And we now have an episode when Avram turns to God and says, Avram, you've made promises to me. How do I know they'll come true? I have anxiety. V'yom Hashem, which is a Jewish trait from time immemorial. V'yom Hashem, elokim b'ma'ida kirashena. He says, God, how do I know that I will inherit the promises that you've made? Amar Avram, what does that mean? This sounds a little galling. God's made you a promise, and you say, okay, God, I hear your promise, but can we have that in writing or something? Sounds like, Avram, that's not how you speak to God. So the Gemara is going to explain, what does Avram mean? I'm Avram, Ron Shalom, it's master of the universe. Shemi Yisrael Chotim Lefanech, Atasim Kedor Malam Kedor HaPlaga. I'm not saying you don't keep your word. I'm saying we don't keep our word. And you've said, I'm going to make you a promise to give you the land. And presumably that's conditional on good behavior. You're not going to give us, if we turn into a rabble of tribal murderers, you're not going to give us the land. So how do I know that my descendants are going to keep their part of the bargain? Amalei Lav, he says, no, Amr al-Fanav. He said, Ron Shal Olam. He said to him, no, meaning it's not going to happen. Don't worry about it. Amr al-Fanav, Rosh Mishalom, Hodiyana b'marishon. He says, okay, but how do I know that they're not going to sin? Or even if they sin, there'll be a way back. Amr al-Ley says, Khali Egla Mishaleshav Oz Mishaleshav. That's when he said to him, okay, we're going to do the Brit Ben Abitarium. Which sounds like historically it's just his way to stop Avram worrying about it, and says, we're going to make a covenant now where you're going to split up these animals in half, apart from which animal doesn't get cut in half? Yeah, tweeting, birds don't get cut in half, but all the animals get cut in half. And what the Gemara is suggesting is that was God's answer. That wasn't God saying, you want to know how they're going to inherit? Let's do this covenant. He says, you want to know how they'll inherit the land? Korbanot. Sacrificial practice is the way to keep everybody on the straight and narrow. Ram Lefanov, Ban Shal Olam, and he says back to God at that point, Tenach Bishban Shabbat HaMikdash Kayam. So that works when the Beit HaMikdash is functioning. Korbanot will keep them on the straight and narrow. And what's going to happen when there's no temple? Amalo, and this is a very important next three lines for liturgical purposes. It comes up in Megillah and elsewhere as well. God says to Avram, Kfar tikanti lahem seder korbanot. I've already established them the text about sacrifices. Bizman shekorin bahen, and when they read this text, I consider it as if they have brought the korbanot. So if you read the korbanot, it's like you have brought the korbanot. So that's why liturgically we do korbanot in the morning. You would have thought you'd do it a little later in davening when people have kind of shaken off the sleepiness. This is right up front, and that's why, I mean, there are different traditions how much you say. There are some shuls that you've got pages and pages and pages of korbanot. Growing up in the Anglo practice is, I think, basically what we do here, or maybe a little more than what we do. You do Korban Tamid, Vayidaber Hashem, and then you got the Bright of Rabbi Yishmael. Do we do the Bright of Rabbi Yishmael here?
Yeah, yeah.
It is said here?
Something was called out.
Yeah, something moves quickly.
The Siddur directory to skip all the Korban.
Which Siddur? The Art Scroll?
The Chazan Siddur.
Oh, the Chazan said it. There you go. So I've seen this in it. So either way, it seems to be pretty central that this is the guarantee that we have a relationship with God. And there is a large discussion on the basis of this. What about other mitzvot that we can't do? If I read about them, it's as if I've done the mitzvah, and there's a debate about if there are mitzvot that we're incapable of, whether it's pidyon chamah or other things, should we just read the psukim and it's as if we've done the mitzvah? Okay, full stop. So it sounds like what we've established so far, some of the history about the establishment of the Ma'amad, how central the Ma'amad is, that's why you would say Ma'aseh Bereishit. And if you were designing the liturgy for those who represent, for example, you think about members of Congress, Lahavdil, Elef Havdil, members of Congress, and you'd say on their weekends off, what passages should they read? Or what should the invocation be every morning? They always have a pastor of some sort giving an invocation every morning. What should the subject of the material be?
And
sometimes it's a constitution, often you've got people talking about freedom, peace, and, you know, if someone said, well, why don't you stand up and talk about creation? You say, well, firstly, you're a loony creationist, what are you doing up here? But the sentence is, without government, we could not subsist. And here, without korbanot, the universe would collapse. That is our bridge to heaven. Tan Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, Anshe mishmar hayumit palim an korba acheihem, shid kabel baratza. Part of the role of the Ma'amad, and it says Anshe Mishmar here, but it's talking about the Ma'amad who were at the Mishmar. So the general citizens of the Jewish people who were standing there supervising, were they just gawking at the Kohanim, or what did they do? Mitpalelim al korban achem shekabaratzen. They would pray that the korban would be received peacefully. Vanshe Ma'amad, and what would the other Ma'amad do who were not in Yerushalayim but in the general synagogues around the country? Mitkansim levet ha'kneset v'yoshim dalitaniyot. They would fast on 4 days, b'sheni, b'shabas, b'shlishi, b'revi, b'chamishi, on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. There would be 4 fasts. Now, what would you expect this Ma'amad, who have just read Bereshit to connect them and the cosmos to what's going on in Yerushalayim, what are they fasting about for 4 days? What should they have in mind? Yeah, it's not straightforward, meaning self-reflection, keep yourself pious, you're representatives of the people. That's a somewhat insular version of thinking about fasting. And it's now going to say, well, actually, the fasting was to think about particularly the vulnerable people in the population. Because the korbanot is about connecting us to God, but it's not meant to be a singular one-way channel that directs our attention to heaven at the exclusion of the people around us, as we said yesterday at Sudah Shlishit. Ritual in Jewish tradition often is positioned or poised between us and the rest of the people around us. And that's the same here. What is this fasting for? B'sheni, on Monday, who would they fast for? Al Yerdei Hayam. They would fast for those who were traveling by sea. An incredibly dangerous activity in the ancient world. Not that anyone's seen Captain Phillips? No, it can be dangerous. Anyone seen Captain Phillips? Yeah. Yes, my wife still has Mrs. Sleep because of that movie, but I enjoyed it. B'shlishi al Holchei Midbarot. On Tuesday, they would fast for the desert travelers, also a dangerous expedition. Those who've seen Dune may agree with that. I've not seen it, but the trailer makes it look like the desert's a dangerous place. B'ravi al Iskara. On Wednesday, they would fast Shalotipol al Tinoko, that the infants shouldn't suffer from Iskara. Now, Iskara is a disease often described as something to do with the throat clogging up. I don't know what the contemporary equivalent would be, but it's some form of major asthmatic attack of some sort. Diphtheria? I think we brought that up once before. Right, so there you go. Is that a breathing thing? There you go. So diphtheria, they would fast that the young shouldn't suffer. And you might think that these are quite random things. On Monday, they're fasting for the seafarers. Tuesday, they're fasting for the desert wanderers. On Wednesday, they're fasting that the young shouldn't suffer from diphtheria. So it does kind of beg why. And Rashi and other commentaries suggest, well, actually, the creation of what happened on Monday, what was created on the second day? Division between the waters. So that's why they're davening for the seafarers. So they make connections between the days of the week and what they're fasting for. That is the best association of all of them. Why diphtheria on Wednesday? Yeah. So you've got to figure out, well, what was made on Wednesday? No, what was made on Wednesday? The sun and the moon, which are called the lights of the sky. How do you say that in Hebrew? Ma'orot. If you punctuate it differently, me'erat is a curse. So you want to avoid any curses, so you don't want diphtheria on the babies. Yeah, that's where we're going if we try to make these connections. I could have sat down and tried to speculate connections too, and I did for a few minutes, and then I thought, we can all do this, and I don't have any special authority to do that, so I'll...
It sounds a little bit from the Lashon that it's like also Dalet Srikh and Lahut, the Pochen and Baros.
Right, it's very similar to the four who have to say, bring a Korban Torah and say, Berachat HaGomel, although you would have thought an exact parallel would be helpful. The Midbar, the ocean, prison doesn't appear.
See, I just left the baby in the uterus. It's like in prison.
Oh, interesting. There we go. So we can make some neat connections here. They do all seem to be connected to thirst to some degree, other than being in the sea, although water everywhere, but not a drop to drink. So you can be thirsty in the ocean, but you're cut off from food. In the desert, you're cut off from food. With diphtheria, you're cut off from consumption. And the things in the last group is... where are we? B'chamishi. First one line is Shalom. B'chamishi on Thursday, ala uborot umeinakot. They would fast for those who are pregnant and those who are nursing. Uborot shlo yapilu, they would pray for the pregnant that they shouldn't miscarry, minokot she'anikot b'neihem, and for the nursing that they should be able to successfully nurse their children. They obviously didn't have formula in the same way that we do, and these were major anxieties. And this is also about, to some degree, thirst, but I don't have more to go on than that. But these were seen as particularly pertinent groups who need fasting for. Of Erev Shabbat Mitanim, and they wouldn't fast on Fridays when they covered a Shabbos, because it was covered Shabbos last month. Of course, they wouldn't fast on Shabbat. But Echad B'Shabbat Mitanim Allah, why don't they fast on Sundays? Now, we did mention last week in the Mishnah, but it was in brackets, and some say that was not in the original Mishnah, and this is a clue that it may not have been, because it's now saying, why didn't they fast on Sunday? The Mishnah said that you don't fast on Sunday because you don't want to go straight from Shabbos when you're eating and drinking into a Sunday and not eat, because what happens? You die. It says Shiamutu that you're going to suddenly die if you fast after you've eaten. Of course, that would pose a problem for Yom Kippur, where we say the day before you should be eating all day long. So why don't they fast on Sunday? Three possibilities. Rabbi Yochanan notes from the first reader of Yochanan says because of the Nazareans, who sometimes we call Christians, where Sunday was a sacred day. So we don't fast on the Sunday. We don't want associations with that ritual practice. Rabbi Shulman Nachmani, Amar B'nei Shlishli Yitzira. Some say you don't fast on Sunday because Sunday is the third day after creation. When was creation? Presumably.
When was creation?
Which day of the week?
Was creation?
Yeah.
6 days.
Which day did it start? It started on Sunday. So why is Sunday the third day of creation? When was humanity made?
Friday.
So it's the third day of creation for human beings. And this is something, when we talk about what day of creation was Shabbat, Shabbat's always the seventh day, but for human beings, it's like day one. So there's a distinction there. So here you've got man is made on Friday. Woman is made on Friday. That's day one. Shabbos is day two. Sunday is day three. What happens on the third day after any major event? What happens on the third day after circumcision? It hurts. I mean, I'd say it hurts on the second day and the fourth day too. But in rabbinic tradition, the third day particularly is the worst time. What textual evidence do we have the third day is the worst time after Brit Milah?
Vayera.
Vayera is rabbinic tradition, that Avram was sitting out there and then the rabbinic midrashim say this was the third day after Brit Milah. Shechem, right, where the whole city is circumcised as a deal with Yaakov. They say you can marry Dina, but all of you need to be circumcised. They're all circumcised. And it says on the third day they were all very weak, and Shimon and Levi decided to use that as an opportunity to make friends. To kill them all. So the third day is seen as a very weak time. So the Gemara says, well, Sunday, historically, is the third day for humanity. That's why we have Sundays off, because we're all weak on Sundays. And that's why Israelis power through, but they're trying to legislate to give Sundays because everybody's exhausted. So that's one reason why we don't fast on Sundays, because it's a day of weakness for human beings. Reish Lakish, Amar Reish Lakish, the third reason, Mipnei Neshama Yetera, for the extra soul has dissipated. Dam Reish Lakish, Lakish says, Neshama Yetera, Nitna Baba Adam, Ber Shabbat, on going into Shabbos on Friday, we're given an extra soul, but Motzei Shabbat, Notlin Otam Emenu, on Motzei Shabbat, as Saturday night comes, it's taken away. Shneimar, as it says, Shabbat Vayinofash, it says, God rested, Vayinofash, and was refreshed, But the word vayinafash can be phonetically broken up into kivan sheshavat, since they rested, vay avda nefesh. Woe, my soul is gone. And that is the phonetic origin for the notion that we have an extra soul put into us on Friday and it dissipates on Sunday. So why don't we fast on Sundays in the Ma'amad? Surely we've got people other than seafarers and nursing mothers who need our help. Well, we don't fast on Friday because Shabbos is coming. We don't fast on Shabbos because it's Shabbos, and we don't fast on Sunday either because it's the Christian holiday we want to avoid association with that, or because it's the third day of human creation and we're weak, or because we've lost our Shabbos soul and we're still weak. So those are the three possibilities why we don't fast on a Sunday every week. Of course, there are Sundays on which we fast. For example, Tisha B'Av, I think this year as well, it's going to be on a Sunday, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, Ninche to a Sunday, Shavuot, Shabbat, Tammuz. There are fasts we do on a Sunday, so it does happen, but we don't inaugurate that the Ma'amad every week would have to fast on a Sunday, full stop. We'll do 3 more minutes. Let's see how far we get in the yellow. So we said, what did they lane from Maaseh Bereishit? So we said there were 8 psukim, essentially, each day. A big section of 5 and a small section of 3. And this is where the question is going to come up. The 3 I get, you're going to have somebody get an aliyah for the 3. What do you do with the 5? Tan Bereishit, it was taught, Bereishit, B'shnayim Yirakiya, Be'echad, you'd have 2 people doing the first 5, and you'd have Yirakiya, Be'echad, the 3 psukim of that section, that leaned by 1 person, B'shlam, Yirakiya, Be'echad. It makes sense that the 3 psukim of Bereishit 1, 6 to 8, would be 1 person. Tlata psukei hava, that's 3 psukim. Ela Bereishit B'shnayim, but you're going to have from Genesis 1:1 to Genesis 1:5, Hip psukim havi, and how do you have 2 people read that? That's 5 psukim, and it's taught. Tanana karabit Torah al yifchad migul psukim. You don't have less than 3 psukim for each person. How do you get 5 to 2 people? Rav Amadola, Rav says you skip back and you do 1 to 3, and then 3 to 5, and that's 3 each. Shmuel amar posik. Shmuel says no, you break it in half. You do 1 to 2.5, and then 2.5 to 5. V'rav damadolag, and Rav says you go back. My tamalo posek. It seems to make much more sense not to go back and repeat yourself. You just read that. Why don't you split it in half? Much easier. Kasavar, he holds kopsuk lo psika Moshe analo baskin analysis. Any divide that Moshe didn't make, we don't have the authority to make. So this again ties back to the, does Moshe or later prophets have the power to make regulative decisions? And here we're being told, if Moshe made sentence breaks, we don't have the right to repunctuate any verses. It's much better that we repeat ourselves than we break up verses that Moshe made. Shmuel Amar Posek. Shmuel says you should break it up in the middle. Mi baskinan. Hold on. Whoever breaks things up. From Rabbi Chanina, who was a teacher of children, said, Sar gadol hayili, etzel Rabbi Chanina hagadol. I had a lot of problems with the big Rabbi Chanina. Velo hitoli lipsok ala tinokat. The only time he let me break up psukim was to teach Shnogashal Beit Rabban, the young children, Hod Lamed Asuyim, because they needed to learn. That was the only way to teach them in small sections. Otherwise, he would never let me split up psukim. Shmuel hatam tam amay mishum dlay efsha hachanami lay efsha. He'd say, yeah, it's impossible there not to break it up. In our case, also, it's impossible not to break it up. If you're forced, you break it up. Shmuel amar posek, and Shmuel says you should split it up. Just what's the logic to permit that? What's his logic not to go with doleg? My tam la amar doleg. Gzerim shem nechnasim, gzerim shem ayotzim. He made a decree because people walking in and out of shul, which never happens, obviously, people coming late or people leaving early. But if somebody came to shul late, and they arrived when the Levi was getting called up, and the Levi started from Pasuk Gimel, what might the Levi be thinking? He's thinking, I'm not paying attention to the Levi. But he walks in, he says, they start on Gimel. That means, what did the Kohen get? He only did 2 psukim. Oh, so it must be 2 psukim is okay. And what about people who leave early? People who leave early are going to leave after Pasuk 1 to Gimel's been read, and they know what's coming for the rest of the lane. They think, oh, they finished Gimel. It must be. They're going to do just Dal and Hey. They do 2 psukim. So he's worried that people walking in and out are going to start losing track of the rule that you have to do 3 psukim at least per laning. Now, why do you have to do 3 psukim each for each laning? Why is that a minimum? So lane 2 psukim, what's the end of the world? So this is a decree from the time of Ezra that minimally you have to have 3 psukim read together to preserve context, which is an interesting rule that you cannot lay in a pasuk on its own because it would be bereft of its surroundings. So you have to have 3 together. So what we have being debated here, what is more important to preserve? The verse as Moshe designated it, and we don't break that up, or the 3 verses of communicative context that we don't want people to break up? Are we preserving the unit of Torah as it is taught and spoken, or the unit of Torah as it is scripted and written? And there's debate. What are we trying to preserve? Torah as a mechanism of teaching, or Torah as a matter of text? from the past. So that's partially what's being debated here. So why don't you skip back? He says, Gezeira. Meitfei, we're going to finish with this. Obviously, because it's the end of the page. He says, hold on a minute. You're going through this whole debate. If you've got five psukim available, do you skip? Do you split? What do you do? And the Gemara says, hold on a minute. There's a brayta that had this issue. Parsha shoshim psukim, if you've got six psukim, currently be shnayim shel chamisha b'yachid. If you've got six psukim, you read it with two, three each. If you've got five psukim b'yachid, you only do it with one person. You can't divide that up anymore. V'imarishon karagimol, but if somebody called up and they read psukim, three psukim and stopped, what do you do? And this comes up in laning often. You'll do something and you're like, oh, we made a mistake. What do we do? And then one looks at me and I look at someone and then we figure something out. So what happens if you said there are five psukim? You can only lane five with one because you can't split it up. And then somebody stopped laning after the third pasuk and somebody said the after bracha, and then they look at the rabbi and they say, oh, what do we do? There's only two psukim left. Do we go back? Do we skip? So usually you'd say, oh, well, Rav and Shmuel have this debate. Should we go back? Well, you already did three. We can't split, so go back. But it doesn't say that. What does it say? So the rabbi would say, so read the two psukim you're up to and do one more from the next section. And some say, Gimel, you should do three more from the next section. Because you have to have at least three from each section. Okay, happily resolved. So why don't we just have the same debate? Just go back and go back and do an extra verse. The Gemara says, no, Shani Hatam, it's different there. Three more words to it, Le Ravacha, because they had space, they could go on to the next section. In our case, you've got eight psukim, and that's it, because the next section is being read tomorrow. So you can't get into tomorrow's laning today, so you've got eight psukim. You've got five being read among two. How do you do it? And the next section is the next Aliyah already. So you've only got five. Do you split or do you skip? That's the debate. Full stop. Next time, we'll do Chafchet. Ruchdan, 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 Ruchdan